Thank you. Please turn up the handouts, and we are in 1 Corinthians 15 for our last session 3. And we've said that why bother is the 1 Corinthians 15 question. Why bother? Why bother with being a Christian? And the verse we've just been memorizing, sort of, calls it work and labor, those two words at the end of verse 58. So I wonder, had you noticed that being a Christian is hard? Because the Corinthians hadn't. So to be a Christian in Corinth, in the church in Corinth, they were all about looking great. They were all about being the most spiritual, about getting noticed, about having the highest rank in the church, about suiting themselves, serving themselves. And Paul, all the way through the letter, is preparing them for verse 58. To be a Christian is about work and labour. And yesterday we looked at our morals and our martyrdom. And today is, more mundane, more boring, perhaps more important. Today is about our hard work for the Lord. Most Christian service is hard work and looks unimpressive. And again, you could skim through the letter to find examples of that. In chapters 8 to 10, it's about giving up your freedoms so that that would benefit other Christians. It's about becoming a vegetarian. It's about refusing to take a salary. It's about changing where you will eat with your friends so that you don't lead other Christians astray. It's about giving up alcohol or whatever it would be to fit in with your neighbours. It's those kind of things. Boring, mundane, restrictive. Chapters 12 to 14 are about using whatever abilities God has given us, not so that they benefit us, but so that they benefit others. To the church that was so excited about speaking in tongues and supernatural gifts, Paul says, well, maybe you shouldn't speak in tongues. Well done, I'm glad you do, but please don't, is chapter 14, if that would benefit other people more. Do whatever would benefit other people most. And chapter 16 is about money. It says, please would you use your money to love other Christians with it. Just very boring, mundane things, really. Or chapters 1 to 4, Paul talks about the hard work of ministry. Talks about his own ministry and the kind of language he uses for his own ministry. He uses servant, labourer, fellow worker, gardener, planter, builder, foolish, weak, dishonoured, persecuted, slandered to describe his own ministry. And I wonder whether any of those words fit the ministry you're involved in. Is your ministry hard work? When we're halfway, almost, aren't we, through 2017? Were you more tired last year than any other year before that? And now it's halfway through 2017 and already you're more tired than you were in 2016. Why bother? Why bother? Well, first day we said bother because Jesus really rose, which means second day, you will really rise. You will certainly rise if Jesus really rose. We've just got one tiny extra piece to put into that this morning. You will really rise with better bodies. That's all we're really adding this morning. Jesus really rose means you will certainly rise with better bodies. And look down at verse 35, that's their question. I think really that has been their big objection all along. He's kind of delayed answering it till he's got some other pieces in place. Here is their objection. What kind of bodies? What kind of bodies? Answer, verses 35 to 49, better bodies. And he answers by pointing to Jesus' body. He answers by pointing to Jesus. We will have bodies like the resurrection body of the Lord Jesus. That's the kind of core piece of argument here. Because verse 35 looks like a really good question. In fact, such a good question that over lunch yesterday, several people began asking me the question in verse 35. That's always encouraging, isn't it? So verse 35, Paul says dead people are going to get up out of their graves and will live again with bodies. So presumably with sort of teeth and hair and toenails and all the rest of it. And I hope you can hear the mockery behind verse 35. How are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? So do you hear the mockery? All right then, Paul. Okay, how old will we be? What do you think? Will a six-month-old baby kind of crawl and dribble for all eternity? Or are we all going to look like sort of identical Topshop models so we can't really tell each other apart? And we could add in, if you want to be scientific about it, what if one of the molecules that was part of Paul 2,000 years ago is in my lunch today and then becomes part of my eyelids? You know, when we both get raised from the dead, who is going to have that molecule? How's it going to work? And Paul's answer is, we will have bodies like Jesus' resurrection body. Our section ends in verse 49, saying exactly what verse 22 really laid the groundwork for. Verse 49, just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, that's Adam, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven, that's Jesus. So you think about all the resurrection appearances of Jesus that he went through up to verse 11. They weren't just there for proof purposes. Actually, he needs those loaded because he's now going to say, your body will be like that. So think about those appearances. Jesus, he is really Jesus. And he has wounds in his hands. It's the same person. He is the same man talking to his same friends. But there are major, major differences. And not being dead, that is just the beginning of the differences. That doesn't exhaust them. He is now indestructible. He's transformed into a new sort of being alive. And given they believe that about Jesus, is it really so hard to think that we would be changed in the same kind of ways? That's the argument. So let me see if I can show you that's what he's saying, how he's doing it. So first bit, verses 35 to 41, I've called it the GCSE science textbook. Verse 36, he's not very polite. You foolish person! What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. So he's doing very basic biology, just doing basic, simple biology. Here's the point. Seeds and plants, that's the plant, they look very different. You missed it, didn't you? The ones taking notes. Seeds and plants, they look very different. That's basic biology. The seed, they're not really anything, a seed, unless you put them in the ground and they break apart and they die and then you get a plant. That's how it works in basic biology. Verse 42, he's saying the seed is our bodies now. What you sow is the body you have now compared to the plant, the body that you will have. And the lesson from basic biology is you are used to a world in which there are amazing transformations. And it would be crazy to argue backwards from what seeds are like to say, I don't believe in plants. There couldn't be a plant. There is definitely, there's a lot of difference, isn't there, between a little tiny seed and the fir tree, 70-foot tall fir tree that is out of the window just over there. They are different. But ever since we first grew cress on a piece of soggy blotting paper from school, we've been happy with the basic biology. Seeds turn into plants. That's how it works. And the God who is able to create the science that brings 70-foot tall fir trees out of tiny little seeds, he is able to take your dead body and create something very, very different. That's the point. Verse 42, so it will be with the resurrection of the dead. And the body that you sow is perishable. In other words, you're right. It is stupid to think of these bodies living forever. It's stupid. It's grotesque. It's just like thinking that you could take a kind of fir cone and hang baubles and tinsel on it and say it was a Christmas tree. It's really, it's just not designed for that. You sow a body like this, it dies, and God, the all-powerful creator, he raises a body that is imperishable, just like it worked with Jesus. There was an old body and a new body, and they're related. You can see the wounds on his hands. Fir trees are related to the seeds that they come from. Something to do with DNA. I don't really understand it, but they're related. But Jesus' body is still very, very different to what was sown. And while Paul has the GCSE biology book open, he points along to the next page and he says, just look at everything that God made. So verse 39 to 41, do you see again why I said I think Paul is in Genesis chapter 1? We're kind of ticking our way through the things that God made in Genesis 1 here. God made humans and animals and birds and fish, and also verse 41, the sun, the moon and the stars. And the point here is that God knows that they are all different. He's not confused between them. He knows they're different, and God has experience of putting the right thing in the right place. Verse 40, there are heavenly things like stars and planets, and the Creator, he knows they are different from earthly things like ants and frogs. And not once has he brought to life a frog in the deep outer reaches of space when he meant to create a star in a black hole. God never did that to a frog in the middle of nowhere. He never did that. God knows the difference. So yes, you would need, I would need, a very, very different kind of body if all Christians are going to be raised and live forever. But the God who made everything, he has that in hand. He knows about that and he has it in hand. And in fact, the GCSE science textbook needs a new chapter, verses 42 to 44. So imagine your GCSE science textbook or whatever you had when you did those sort of exams, and you flick past insects and fish and amphibians and mammals and spiders who quite rarely have no friends and need their own chapter, and you keep going, and there should be, in a properly scientific textbook, there should be a chapter for new bodies, resurrection bodies, for new bodies made for new people that are appropriate for the new creation. I don't know if you know a biology lecturer or a biology teacher, you might want to suggest to them that their course is incomplete and anti-scientific, because Jesus Christ rose in the real scientific world. He was seen, he was touched, he caused effects that are still rippling around the world in our real physical universe. So there should be a chapter on resurrection bodies, on his kind of body, because that happened in the scientific universe, the kind of body that Christians will have. One of those bodies already exists. When Jesus died, he rose, he went into heaven. He did not dematerialize at that point. He has that body. He never dies again. That kind of body exists, the kind of body that we will have. And verses 45 to 49 proves it will really happen for us by, again, making the link between us and Jesus, what we said yesterday. God the Creator, he is making a new creation. That was always the plan. Soul, spirit, floaty was never the plan. Genesis 1, Revelation 21 was the plan. The Creator is making a new creation with a new Adam and a new race of people who will have bodies like the new Adam. So verse 45 quotes from Genesis chapter 2, where it says that Adam became a living being, or literally the word there is a living soul. That's what happened in Genesis 2. But Jesus, he is way beyond that, because he is the last Adam, and he became a life-giving spirit. Do you hear that in two ways he is an upgrade on Adam? He's not just living, he is life-giving, and he is not just a soul, he is a spirit. So what Paul has done, he's taken us back to sort of the most exciting bit of the creation story, the most exciting bit where God makes a kind of human shape and lays it out on the ground, and then he leans over it, and in the best kind of mouth-to-mouth there's ever been, he breathes into the nostrils, and Adam lived. Adam became a living being, or a living soul. Well, verse 45 says there has been a sequel. Jesus' body, just the same really, was laid out on the ground in the tomb. And God has acted on that body in the same kind of way. But when he did that, he did not put Jesus back to where he was before his death. It's not a resuscitation. The resurrection does far more than that. The resurrection changes the kind of human being that Jesus is. And Jesus is spirit, where Adam was only soul. And Jesus can give out life to anybody who is in him, the verse says, anyone who is attached to him. He's actually completely different from Adam. He's as different as earth and dust is different from heaven. So verse 49, end of the logic, just as every human being has borne the likeness of Adam, I think meaning in particular that dust keeps turning back to dust, so every Christian in the new creation will bear the likeness of Jesus. And verses 45 to 49 explain the differences between them. New creation equals new Adam equals new bodies. And the force of the verses there is in the contrasts, the differences. So I've put them in a box on the sheet, which I think enables us to line them all up next to each other. That would be, if you're a biology teacher, if you're going to write that chapter in the textbook, here is what you need to put in. Here is the information about that kind of body. That is what is different. Lots and lots and lots of contrasts. Do you remember Greek culture in Corinth despised bodies, had a real thing against bodies. Bodies are weak and falling apart and dishonorable. And Paul says, yeah, you're right. You're right. These bodies are. That is what they're like. That is what they're like. And God's answer to that, though, is not something less physical. God sees the problem, but the answer is not something less physical, all about clouds and floatiness and shining lights. God's answer is something more physical. Let's take the problem that you've noticed, caused by Genesis 3 and sin, and let's make something more physical. Now, I think we just need to concentrate on something a little bit technical for a second, though if you're not interested, you phase out by all means, and I'll tell you when to come back in. Do you see in verse 46 or verse 44, the contrast between the bodies is described as natural and spiritual in the English translation? And it might be that makes you think that we're actually undoing a lot of what we've said over the course of these talks. That maybe you have a natural physical body, and the one we'll get in the future is spiritual, in other words, not physical. People see the problem, and the word, the verses, it's there in verse 44 twice. It's actually there in verse 45, and it's there in verse 46. And what I've put in the box is something that gives you access to the Greek word underneath. So when Paul says natural, the word he uses is soul, psukekos. And when he says spiritual, the word he uses is pneuma, pneumatikos. So you have a soul-ish body or a spirit-ish body. Those are the two options there. And we read natural and we think that means physical, and we read spiritual and we think that means floaty. So we think, actually, Paul, you've just thrown away what you've been saying all the rest of the chapter. And again, Tom Wright's book that somebody bought and is therefore not there anymore, very, very helpfully goes through those two options. And says the word soulish, if Paul meant at all to say physical there, he has chosen completely the wrong word when he chooses the word soul or psuche. Because in Greek thinking, you had a body and a soul inside the body. And the point was the soul was the bit that was going to escape. And that was the floaty bit, the souly bit. What he's actually doing is comparing two sorts of body with different insides in them. Does that make sense? So we don't have a physical body and a non-physical body. We have a physical body with a soul, and we have a physical body with a spirit. Those are the two types of body, which is why verse 45 is really important. Adam became a living soul when his body had wind blown into it, living soul, but Jesus became a living spirit, a body with a spirit. And we might want to talk about the differences and quite how that relates to the Holy Spirit. But for now, the point is we have these two eras of humanity, and they are both physical. That's very important. And they are not the same, because we have one body now, and in the future we will have a better body. That's the point. If you've been lost in all that, come back now. Okay, come back now. What we've said is two physical bodies, and the future one is better. That's what matters. So what I want to do is enjoy a couple of these contrasts. So let's take the third one down. This may work for some people. This body is sown in weakness, but raised in power. So it was interesting, wasn't it, yesterday that Nigel was very happy to click the option that was the kind of super ripped torso on the side there. So this is maybe for all the blokes who spend all their time pumping iron. So however focused on your body you are, and however successful you are at getting the kind of muscles on top of muscles that normal people don't have, even those guys are complete weaklings compared to the body that we will have in the new creation. It will be a body of power. We don't live, remember YOLO? You only live once. We said that was a lie. Actually, you live twice. Well, now we add, you live twice and you get better bodies the second time round. Just a very small change, but let me see if I can tell you the kind of difference it will make. Some of you know that this summer I'm off on a kayaking trip, and one of the things, because of that, it's amazing how much kit you need to buy to go off on a simple little trip, but one of the things I'm shopping for is a spare phone. Okay, because I have this one phone that is kind of super whizzy and it takes photos and it can do Facebook and it can do email and it can go on the internet, and it's probably got more computing power in it than the computer that I got 2 years ago, let alone the one that I had 10 years ago, and it does everything. But as well as that, because I'm going somewhere that is salty and wet and kind of active, I want a spare phone. So what I'm looking for there is the cheapest possible phone that has the lowest possible specifications, so that when I drop it in the sea, I won't be that sad. And the spare phone, I hope it will just be able to make phone calls and do texts. And it will have a little bit of memory, it'll have a little bit of brain on it, and that'll be fine. Now, which body is the one you're currently sitting in? Do you see the difference this makes? You don't only live once, you live twice. The life in the future is the better one, the better body, which means that this life is your spare life. See how that makes a difference? Why you could, verse 58, always abound in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. When you deny your body things, give up things that your body would like now, our culture thinks that is a stupid thing to do. And I understand, I was back at Sir Helen's last night. I understand we didn't interview Helen last night, but we're going to over the next month or so, Helen Foster. I don't know how much we'll bully her in the interviews. Where is Helen? And make her talk about what it's like. But I've heard some stories about the shower that is a bucket of cold water at the end of the... Is that still the situation? Okay, so you know, what are you doing in human terms? In moving from nice London, where you have showers that can squirt hot water at you from all the way around you and everywhere, to a bucket at the end of the garden, if cold water, what are you doing? Well, if this body, that body, is the spare one, you're not being an idiot at all. And you can always abound in the work of the Lord and give yourself to it if it's the spare body. So let's pick another contrast. Maybe pick the first one. Perishable versus imperishable. These bodies, we've just heard, haven't we, chicken pox? These bodies are so perishable. Let me give you a fun driving story that I picked up from the newspapers. This is a story about driving tests for the over 70s. And the story, it came with a photo of the gentleman who reversed his VW Polo all the way up the bonnet of a Ford Galaxy. And he didn't stop until he'd made it onto the roof, and his front wheels were stuck in the windscreen. And he said, I didn't notice the car behind. there's a photo, so it must be true. It's a 40-degree angle, and he's kind of sat there up at the top. Now, that, I guess, is a comedy story, but actually, growing old is not funny at all, is it? It's horrible. I'm not going to talk you through my family's experiences of it, but we all know it. Your eyes going and strength weakened and brains confused. What body will we have? Well, not one like this one. Doesn't matter how young you are or strong you are or what indestructible you feel. Not one like this. And we will be imperishable. We will not get old. We will not break. we will not, Adam's sin and God's punishment for it means dust keeps on going back to dust, and there's no way out of that. But Jesus' resurrection gives life, glorious and permanent and imperishable. And I think it doesn't matter what age you are to think that sounds achingly wonderful. So the Corinthians, they had stopped bothering because all they were looking forward to was a new soul, not a new body. But actually, we are going to have new bodies. And all the things that we want for our bodies now, if we miss out on some of those things now, that is not in vain. Remember, that was the key word, through. Because we'll have better bodies. And when I'm talking to students in London, I can acknowledge to them it would be very hard, wouldn't it, to give up any of being young, free and single in London if this life is the only crack at it that there is. But if this body is just a seed, well, then you could give it up. The group leader could keep working at their Bible studies. The person who comes in to set up Little Pickles could give up their Friday morning. The person who stays late to reset the church or whatever it is, you can drag yourself in and keep doing it. And because it is worth it. And I think all of us will have different areas where the labor and work of the Lord runs up against wanting to keep this body and this life for myself. So what I want to do, I want to try a few examples in public so that what I hope is over lunch and over the next few weeks, we could try them out with each other and see what would be the big issues for us. So maybe think about our evangelism for a second. I've twigged that we hate the prosperity gospel because we think that is untrue, and the idea that being a Christian makes you rich. But I think we may have fallen for something I call the popularity gospel, which goes like this, that God definitely wants me to be liked. And actually that is part of what being a good Christian is. That the point of Christian morals actually is to make you a nice person so that everybody likes you. That's the kind of benefit that God has promised to me. And my body wants to be liked. It's actually really lonely being disliked, particularly by your family or your neighbours or your children's friends. And if this life was the only chance to be liked, well, you could see why we'd want to maximise being liked. But actually, if there is a proper life to come or a better life to come, well, maybe then we could go with the hits of evangelism without caring so much. I remember, this isn't about evangelism, but I think the same applies. I remember going on a conference where a group of student workers, we were all whinging about working with students and how students keep you up late and you don't really get to bed and you're tired, and that makes it very difficult to read the Bible in the morning. And, you know, so then you get more tired and it's just so hard, isn't it? And we were having one of those breakout sessions where everyone's meant to go, yes, you're right, it's hard, isn't it? And we all go on unchanged from what we were doing. And a friend of mine, he said, why not be tired? Which to me was a radical thought. Why not get up early, read the Bible, and be tired? Obviously, there might be limits on that. The point at which you start falling asleep while you're driving, you need a Google car and then you care. But why not be unpopular, actually? What would be the worst that could happen if we have a better life to come, better bodies? Or you could do this maybe with career decisions. If we only have one life, well, I could see why we would want a well-paid career and a nice house and a happy family, or why we'd want public recognition that our life had been valuable. But actually, if you have two lives, then you could spend one. Spend every day given fully to the work of the Lord. And I think I won't go back over what Paul said, but I think it's exactly right, isn't it? Actually, if you had two lives, then you or your children, it's always Christian parents, by the way. Christian. When I try and encourage students to go into full-time Christian work, nearly always it's the Christian parents that give the most hassle on that, which is really interesting, isn't it? Don't throw your life away doing what... remember Jonathan Fletcher saying, God the Father, he had one son, and he sent him to be a preacher. So maybe your child could do that and it wouldn't be a total shame. What would it mean in our very different context to live a life always abounding in the work of the Lord. I've given these talks in several different situations. And one time somebody said, okay, what about as you get older? This was down on the Isle of Wight. They said, what about as I get older? I guess that's where everyone goes when they get older, to the Isle of Wight. Does this look different? Is it okay to work less hard as you get older? And I thought about that. And I think verse 58 is the answer. You have to abound, or NIV would say, give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. Mark chapter 8, take up your cross and deny yourself and follow. That doesn't end at age 55. But it might be that what giving yourself fully looks like looks different for different people at different life changes. So the bit that doesn't change is give yourself fully. This is your spare life. But quite what that looks like in practice, that might well change. So I thought about that a bit. I work with currently kind of stereotypically lazy students. And they're all lazy, aren't they? And everyone knows they don't do any work. But I find it very easy to be a lazy 40-year-old, actually. And I suspect it will be possible when I get there to be a lazy retired person. And that actually the questions are the same. They just look different. And the crucial thing is that we're all different and that we shouldn't compare each other to each other. And God is not asking me to do the same as you. It's actually something that has been quite important in staying at St. Helens for 13, 14 years. God is not asking me to do the same amount of work as William. I think if I tried to do that, I would now be dead. And that's fine. But we're not asked to compare ourselves with each other. But nor have I done enough when a few people around me say, oh, you work really hard. So the apprentices that we have at St. Helens, age 21, they look at the work I do and they say, your life is so crazy. And they don't have a clue. It's just because they've never had a proper job in their lives. I know, and the Lord knows, whether I'm giving myself fully or whether I'm treating my body as if this was my only life. So a new mother will have a very different situation from someone whose children have just started going to school, or someone who doesn't have children. Someone who changes job might have less time. But actually, that might be a good reason not to take the job. The most controversial thing I said in the Isle of Wight when I was talking about this was I said, maybe if you're a school governor, you should think about not being. So you could do gospel work. And again, I wonder if that would be some people in the room who are at the stage where they might be giving up work, and there will be a queue of people, given who some of you are, there'll be a queue of people giving you good things to do. Be trustee of this. Come and be chair of this. Actually, and all those things would, you know, people would say that's wonderful. But instead, you could read the Bible with two or three people in one of the congregations at St. Helens, and no one would notice, and no one would care. But that might actually be a better use of retirement. The aim is the maximum possible gospel work, not the earliest death possible. Do you know the story of John Wesley and his horse? Someone asked John Wesley this question. He said, God gave me a horse, and he gave me a gospel. And I flogged the horse to death, and now I cannot tell anyone the gospel. In other words, you need to, the aim is 30 years. If you're 65, we want you to be working fully for the Lord for the next 30 years. So please don't kill yourself through overwork in the next 5 years. And it might be that things need to change. It may be that as you get older, you find you're not able to go down to Speaker's Corner and debate with Muslims every week in the way you used to. But it might be that you spend more time at home praying for Muslims. And that would be fully devoted. And personally, I'm really looking forward to being retired. I think this probably says something about me, doesn't it? That I'm my age and I spend as long as I do thinking about that. But I see the temptation of it. Go and live somewhere near the sea where I could go kayaking every day, or maybe a few months somewhere warm where I could go kayaking and fall in every day. But actually, the work of the Lord will be as urgent in 30 years' time, if Jesus hasn't come back, as it is now. And my 67-year-old body will still be my spare body, if it's still working at all by then. And I hope and pray I would still be given fully to the work of the Lord then. So what I sometimes do with students is I, because obviously they haven't yet made some of the decisions that others of us have, but I kind of think through, I wonder what career you're going to do, wonder what job you're going to get, and I wonder how that would affect how fully you can give yourself to the work of the Lord. So there's people in the room who are probably there when about a decade ago we asked all the leaders of St. Helens, do you think we work you too hard? Which quite a good question, isn't it? People at St. Helens have busy jobs. And someone who is in the room now stood up and said, you do not work us hard enough, because if we were at any other church, we would be leading a home group and running the youth group and doing all the finances. And that you may want to take him aside over lunch and shoot him. But that is what he said. And I thought he said it with some credibility, because I knew at the time anyway, I don't know what he's done since really, but made decisions to not get too promoted and not have his job get busier so that he could give himself fully to the work of the Lord. Is that a waste? Or is that a good decision? Our body can get the career buzz in the new creation. We don't know quite what it'll look like in detail, but you know, houses and holidays and hobbies, there'll certainly be enough time, but we have this spare life now. And the question is, what will we spend it doing? And the most tense place I've ever given this talk was on the City Partnership Summer School, because that's the only time I've ever had parents and their young children in the same room. You know, I've frequently done it one or the other. And I think for me, again, that is where some of this bites. So my children, do I think their life is a spare life? Would it actually, what do I want them to learn? Do I want them to learn that we can throw this life away on the work of the Lord? Or do I want them to have the best possible things that I can afford to give them? And that is where it really bits. Sometimes I talk about money. Do you know the story of Mr. Lang, the builder? So that's a great biography to read, where he made a decision when he was just starting out that he would work out how much money he needed to live on. And then after that point, he would save half of his money and he would give half of it away from that point. And he worked that out really early on, to kind of house and a holiday. And he wasn't kind of mean, but that's what he worked out. And then from there, you'll have seen the cranes. The building company went quite well. And a few years later on, he found that he could meet his number to live on purely from the savings. So at that point, he stopped saving, and everything that he earned from that point on, he gave away to charity. What an idiot, don't you think? Just think how much his body could have enjoyed life, what big houses he could have had, the way he could have lived. Or is he not an idiot because he has a better body to come? New bodies means those kind of decisions are not in vain, because we live twice. And we have one life that lasts forever and is indestructible, and we have one life that is just a bit feeble and falling apart and damaged and can't really enjoy itself very well because sin keeps getting in the way. So which way round should we make the decisions? Okay, we don't have very long left before the children arrive and make a stop. So point three, verses 50 to 57. We should bother because of victory over death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, I hope you've noticed, is a very, very shocking chapter. I've got here a newspaper clipping from a Muslim activist called Hirsi Ali, and she is an activist against extremism. She used to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and she's now an activist against extremism. And this was when David Cameron was Prime Minister, and he was trying to reach out to radical Muslims in order to help sort out extremism. And she thought that was a really bad idea. And here's what she said. She said, you shouldn't try and distinguish moderate preachers from radicals. She said, as long as preachers taught that life after death was more important than life before death, they are part of the problem. I wouldn't want to leave 1 Corinthians 15 without you realizing what we've been saying. That the logic here is the logic of the suicide bomber, isn't it? Absolutely, isn't it? So the suicide bomber, there's a lot of things wrong with the suicide bomber. But his logic is not the problem. So poor, pathetic suicide bomber, his fake god tells him to do hateful, violent things in exchange for a sort of pathetic adolescent fantasy. That's what's wrong with him, but the logic is not the problem. The idea of giving up your life now in exchange for a better life to come, nothing wrong with that. That's Christianity. That is Jesus' teaching. That is the logic. But Hirsi Ali would say that is radical extremism. And I think there's a trick in there. She's saying that, you know, all a moderate Muslim really is, or a moderate Christian, is just the same as an extreme Christian with nicer haircuts and calmer voices, basically. And there's a trick in there. The setup is you have normality as opposed to extremism. And she'd say normality is to care about the here and now and say this life and this world, it is precious and beautiful and noble and moderate and sensible and balanced. And I wonder if even as we've been speaking, you've been thinking, but this world is good. Life in this world is good and it matters and our bodies now are good. That's the setup. That's normality. Whereas radicalism is the kind of live for the future, and that is unhinged and that is radical and that is extreme and that is difficult. I don't think she's being honest. I don't think that is really your choice. Here is the real choice. The choice is about when you will live for, what you will live for. And actually, the category we've had all the way through these talks of labor and work and vanity, things being in vain, that is a very, very rich Old Testament category. The idea that all of your labor and your work might be in vain, that is kind of the book of Ecclesiastes and lots of other places. And I think actually the Hirsi Ali suggestion is a vain, wasted life. The choice isn't between being normal and being radical. The real choice is between working for Jesus or working for ourselves. Between working for the next life or working for now. It's between being radically eternal or radically temporary or radically selfish, if you'd rather. And this life is the temporary, passing, empty, cursed thing. And the word vain is in verse 2 and verse 10 and verse 14 and verse 17 and verse 18 and verse 32 and verse 58. And verses 1 to 49 say your labor is not in vain because you have better guaranteed bodies in the future. But verse 50 to 57 adds something that I'd been teaching on this passage for a decade before I realized what it was. I think verse 50 to 57 says the only vanity-free life available to you is a life devoted to the victory over death. That is the only kind of work available that is not a waste. And because Ecclesiastes, anything else you do will just turn to dust eventually and die and not last. Whereas victory over death and getting other people to eternal life and resurrection and things that matter in the new creation, that is the only kind of life that lasts and is not in vain. So verse 58 then is not just about making Christians feel better about missing out on getting drunk or something. It is actually the answer to the human problem since Genesis 3, which is, but is there any work and labor under the sun that is not empty and in vain? Well, yeah, there is one kind of work, and that is the work that is the victory over death. That is what the work of the Lord means in verse 58. I think, and we're not going to have time to show you, so I'll tell you the verses you can go and check. I think that the work of the Lord in verse 58 is not a generic term for godliness, but is a specific term for a type of work. The verses are 16 verse 10, that's the next one, but then the similar phrase in 9 verse 1 and the category talked about in chapter 3. And each time the work of the Lord, or being God's workmanship, is talking about gospel explaining, Bible teaching, Christian encouraging labor that builds people up into the building, the temple. Again, what Paul's been talking about, that will then last forever. Victory over death work is the work that really lasts. So just to give you the bare bones, verses 50 to 53 says that we will all change. whether we're in the grave when Jesus comes back or we're not yet in the grave. And several people have asked me what happens in between we die and Jesus comes back. And the answer is, I don't know. There you go. I can give you a couple of guesses over lunch if you want. But we will all change on that day and we will get our new bodies. And verse 52, there'll be a big loud alarm clock, louder than the testing the fire alarm this morning. And we will be immortal. Verse 53. And remember, when this letter was written, it was posted to a city very close to Mount Olympus. That's the idea of, you know, the gospel makes you an immortal. That was something that really counted in their world. The gospel makes you Zeus, sort of. You can make, that's what the Christian gospel does. I always think it would be fun to be a doctor every time you go on an aeroplane or you go to the theatre. I think if I was a doctor, I would be hoping that one day someone would come on the tannoy and say, is there a doctor in the house? That's the kind of moment I would live for. And you think, yes, show me, you know. And on the plane, you've got to do, I read about someone did open heart surgery with just a coat hanger and a biro. Don't know quite how that works, but that would be, I think that would be fun. And then I was thinking, I was on a flight and I was thinking, actually, if they did that, I wonder how many Christians there are on this plane. I wonder how many people there are here who could actually make this person immortal. So I wonder if actually, if they do the announcement and the doctor goes up, I wonder if I'm going to go up as well. So actually, would you mind if while the doctor, you know, while she does the stuff with the coat hanger at one end of the body, would you mind if I stood at the head end and told them the gospel? Because however it goes with the coat hanger, as we're halfway across the Indian Ocean, actually, it's going to be far more important that person believes in Jesus and becomes indestructibly alive forever. Isn't that a neat trick? But if you're a Christian, you can do that work. That's the kind of work and labor that is available to you. And verses 54 to 57 talk about death being defeated. And enjoy it a lot. There's some Old Testament quotes there. One is from Isaiah about death being swallowed up. And one of them is from Prophet Hosea. And Paul has just kind of tampered with it in the way that if you're a good centrifocus Bible study leader, you're told not to tamper with the Bible, but Paul is allowed to. And instead of death being summoned by God to punish people, now that Jesus has risen, death is kind of brought in so we can laugh at him. Death, please, can we have a kind of playground fun session, please, with you? Because we want to laugh at how powerless you are. So do you remember we said that death is like a big boss at the end that kills everybody? Well, in verse 55, verse 56, death is the big scorpion boss stabbing everyone with poison and killing them. But somehow Jesus has cut off the poison bit and added a pom-pom like a little poodle hat. So there's death kind of scuttling around. He's going to tap you on the head with his pom-pom. Oh, it's so sweet. Where's your sting, death? You've lost it. Isn't that a good, fun thing to be involved in? What do you want your life to be about? Should our lives be about paying off the mortgage? Or should our life be about God's big project? God's big piece of work? In my mind, I live in the world of Midshipman Hornblower and kind of 18th century naval battles and that sort of thing. It's much more fun to live there. One of my favourite things there is the kind of seizing the ship. Do you know why flags go at half-mast when someone dies? And the idea, it comes from that world, because you haul the flag down, it doesn't go to half, does it? It just goes a little bit down, because when you capture a ship, you put the flag of the conquering power over the top. So the idea is that the invisible flag of death has gone over that person's life. Death has won. And my favourite bit in the books is when we're in some battle with the French and through the smoke clears for a bit and you see a British ship with the flag down a bit and a French flag over the top. And Hornblower says, "Man the boats!" And you all kind of charge across and you swarm up the side and you hit the Frenchman on the head and he says, "Run that flag down and put the colours back up." That's the kind of work you could be involved in. This afternoon and over lunch, encouraging each other and with your non-Christian colleague tomorrow. The kind of rescuing people from the captivity of death work. Let's put Jesus' flag back up. And I don't know, this is a bit kind of, I'm not really the right generation, but I'm told that People used to say, "What did you do in the war, Daddy?" as a kind of emotionally manipulative thing. But there's a bit of that here, isn't there? As London plunges towards death, and as people are pouring into hell, or what did we do with our lives? What did we give ourselves to? What did you do? What work were you doing? And do you want it to be something that, lasted and counted? And let me finish with this. What I do with students, and I'll wind it back a little bit further to see if it works for your children as well, is I kind of do a kind of worst case possible scenario. So let's try and do that realistically. Here's what I do. Let's imagine that your 11-year-old is about to go to secondary school. And imagine that you encourage your 11-year-old to take some radical Christian decisions on the basis that his or her life is her spare life. So instead of maximizing having lots of friends and maximizing exams and maximizing after-school clubs and sport on a Saturday and a Sunday morning, you go for maximizing gospel things. And that could be very costly, couldn't it? There'd be a few fewer friends. There would not be the first county team. There would not be grade 8, might just be grade 6 or whatever it would be. Quite costly. And we keep running that through. Let's say age 16, the GCSEs, you could go for maximum, or you could go for not quite so good because you spend time trying to teach the Bible to school friends. Same at A-levels, maybe less good A-levels, less good university. Everyone goes to university, don't they? You've got to, it's the law. But, less good university. And then maybe while you're at university, this is where I pick up with the students, maybe you could give yourself to gospel work and you wouldn't get a first and you'd just get a 2-1 instead. Or you wouldn't get a 2-1, you'd just get a 2-2. And that'd be pretty costly, wouldn't it? Because after university, you'd have a less good job. And now that might cost as much as £10,000 a year at that point, those kind of decisions. You're on 10 grand less a year. And we could roll that forward another 10 years. And that would then be beginning to cost really quite a lot of money, wouldn't it? Let's assume they could have done really well. And it's 100 grand a year difference. That's pretty significant, isn't it? 100 grand a year difference. And then we roll that forward another, 30? Let's roll it forward another 30 years. And there is a substantially different retirement. The person who made the different decisions, they are going to be playing a lot more golf in a lot nicer places all the time. Let's then keep rolling it forwards. What if we roll that forward another 30 years after that, or another 50 years after that, or another 100, or another 1,000? Here's the thing that I guarantee your friend will not say in the new creation, the friend that you told the gospel to instead of getting an A star. I guarantee your friend will never say, "Do you know, I really wish you'd got an A star. I really wish you'd made area manager." Because the work that lasts and is not futile and pointless is the work that creates indestructible human beings forever. I think the children must be very close now. Is that right? I'm going to lead us in prayer, and Henry's going to tell us what we do next. Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labour is not in vain. Dear Father God, we praise you for a rescue plan that makes a new creation, not just a sort of floaty place to wait. Praise you for indestructible bodies for people who don't deserve them, whose sin would lead to death. Praise you for a life now and work to do that is not vain and futile. And Father, please help us as we speak to each other and think about this and pray that we would make decisions. We'd think about Doncaster, we'd think about overseas, we'd think about what we do with our jobs, with our lives. We would make decisions that use this spare life for the work that will last forever. In Jesus' name, amen.